since you and I last talked. You know, I'm pushing 60, so I got a notice from my broker thing where I save all my retirement and stuff to check my balances. And I have hit every whoopee goal that I set out. This is when I was younger. I probably had no idea what I was doing. But so I'm faced with, wow, okay, so I've hit all my goals. Now what? I feel like an Olympic athlete who won the gold medal. And then you have to kind of like, what's next? Should I push harder? Should I change direction? Should I become a welder? You know,
I hope we're recording this because it's a really germane podcast.
it's all being recorded.
I think that almost anybody who would listen is going through the same situation. If you're an executive, if you've been doing something for, you know, 40, 50, 60 years, you're going to hit that place where you go, you know, I've done it. I've hit all my goals.
Yeah.
So do I grow my business bigger? Do I go for a lifestyle? And I had a really interesting conversation with Bo Burlingham a couple of weeks ago. His podcast went up last week. And he talks about half the people he, you know, do you know who Bo is?
No.
He was editor at large of Inc. magazine for 25 years.
Wow.
And this man is a repository of knowledge for entrepreneurship. Mm-hmm. In so many, through so many business cycles, and he's pragmatic and he's wonderful and thoughtful. One of the most amazing interviews that I've ever had, just because of tapping into that extraordinary depth of experience. And he wrote a book. His last book is called Finish Big, and it talks about entrepreneurial exits, similar to what John Warlow did with Built to Sell. Mm-hmm. But this one, he talked about the psychological impact of people who sell their businesses. And he's more than half the people he interviewed regretted selling their business because they lost their identity.
Wow. Yeah, you know, I could definitely relate to that. A lot of the folks that listen, who listen to this podcast are in build mode. And when you're in build mode, I used to tell my kids this, you know, when you don't have a lot of choices, i.e. you got to put food on the table, take care of your kids, take care of your family, life seems a little bit, quote unquote, easier because you have a path. When I went to school, for example, my daughter's going to school to become an English major. She's going to college. I was went into the College of Engineering, Computer Science. As soon as I set a toe in the door of the college, my whole 4 years was planned. Every That's class right. I needed to take, everything. There were no options. That's so right. You just buckle down. And sometimes it seems that when you have that defined path, life flows a lot easier. The other phenomena that I've been discovering is that if I have too much time on my hands, I seem to not get projects done. But mm-hmm. if I have five projects lined up that I've got to do, somehow they all get done.
Yeah, the miracle of the deadline.
So I'm trying to figure out how to harness this energy, this goodness that we go through when we have these multiple things happening, to focus on being a better prospector, being a better salesperson, whatever that definition is that you have, mm-hmm. but approach it more with that growth mindset that I'm not there yet, mm-hmm. but I will get there. And I just, you know, these are the steps that I'm going to take in order to just get those daily wins, the micro wins, whatever you want to call it,
sure.
to get to that point.
Well, I think that what we have to do is move from this place of knowing what's next to being okay in the uncertainty. We don't yes. know what's going to happen next. You know, it's a wild and crazy world, both politically and economically and spiritually. It's a crazy place. And we have been rewarded, Mary Lou, by our knowledge. We've yeah. been judged by our knowledge. We've been paid for our knowledge. And you and I are at that place because I'm only a few years behind you. I'm 58. And mm-hmm. this notion of what happens next and all the things that I've been rewarded for are starting to disappear. My knowledge of the world of IT is going away because IT is going away.
Right.
So what happens next? And there's this fear of, you know, am I going to fail? Yeah, I've hit all those goals, all those things like you. I, you know, just every one of them has been checked. The box has been checked. And mm-hmm. now what?
Yeah.
It's an interesting philosophical question. Any answers?
I turn to what do I love to do? And I just try to focus on how can I get some improvement out of that? Because everything in life, you can always improve a little bit more.
Indeed.
And the other thing I'd like my folks to really grasp is this notion of turning pure will into habit. Because habit, especially top of funnel, I can't speak for bottom of funnel. So those of you who are rolling your eyes who have closed business, I'm sorry, but I'm top of funnel and you guys should know that. But, you know, I think if you could really focus on changing the behavior from sheer will to determination, to drive, to discipline, and then eventually to habit, that's going to be what's successful. So you wake up in the morning and you not necessarily have your whole day planned, but you have it blocked out so that you can accomplish the things within that block time, single focus, that would allow you to advance whatever it is you set out as your goal. But I think there is a goal, though. One of the things that I'm struggling with now that I got this news about meeting my retirement and financial goals is, what are my new goals? What do they look like? I've been working so hard over the last 30 years to meet the goals that I thought would be so far out there that I would take for, I'd be 100 and I still wouldn't have, you know, made it. So it's really sitting back now and say, okay, I have a couple levers that I know I love to do. One is to have these podcasts, to talk to people, to help them with their prospecting. The other is more of a creative side, which for me, believe it or not, is programming, because that's what I was trained in. So, you know, I want to continue. My other hat in life is a market research analyst, and that business has been actually picking up lately with surveys for employee net promoter score, loyalty, yada, yada, yada. You know, so that's another area that I can focus on. And then I wasn't kidding. I am taking a welding class because I want to learn how to weld. And that project is going to be putting little 4x4 gabions, for those of you who don't know what they are. Look it up, but putting 4x4 gabions in my ravine and stringing LED lights that I can change the color with so my ravine sparkles in the winter.
Oh, magnificent.
So all of those, though, those are all levers, and they're all things that obviously I don't know the first thing about welding, but it's a process. And so, you know, I'm sure, and even in your life, Mark, and with the work that you do with your clients, there is a system, there is a method, there is a process, and really you have to start on that journey and be okay with the fact that you're not mastering it day one.
Absolutely true.
That you're moving along the journey and that you're not there yet, but you will be someday. And you have to have that growth mindset that I am going to get there. It maybe won't be tomorrow, but I am going to do the things that I need to do to progress in a way that's comfortable for me, that I'm not killing myself.
Absolutely true. Well, one of the quotes that came out of our podcast conversation is, discipline is something I have to do and habit is something I do.
Yes.
And that was such a powerful thought for me. And of course, I made a meme out of it and it's all over Twitter because of that. And, you know, you're right. It's about systems. It's about habits that push us forward a little bit every day, whether it's reading or listening to a new podcast or trying something you've never done before, or just the willingness to step out and fail, or the willingness to step out and say, you know, I'm wrong. Mm-hmm. We have to be so right. We've been programmed from kindergarten to be right.
Yeah. And rewarded, like you said, our parents, whenever we have that great piano recital, they get up and clap, but they don't clap or encourage, not all parents, but some parents don't clap or encourage the path that got us to the great recital. Mm-hmm. The daily getting down into the living room, hitting those keys, that notion of, I'm going to work on this every day. Mm-hmm. That's what we really need to reward. Yes, the end result is great and fabulous and wonderful. And, you know, we've all seen our children, our friends and family or colleagues achieve a goal, but it's the path to get there that really should get the reward, because then you're going to take the next goal and do the same type of thing.
And taking those daily steps sometimes can be really boring. Mm-hmm. And, you know, people can laugh at us. And if we consumed a regular diet of standard media, we're going to think that what we're doing is stupid, because they can wrap up any problem in 30 minutes. And that's just not the way life works. Mm-mm. Life is a series of challenges and triumphs and disappointments and challenges and triumphs. Mm-hmm. And that happens in prospecting, and that happens at the bottom of the funnel too. And let's talk about the bottom of the funnel just for a moment.
Okay.
You mentioned the fact that, you know, bring people that close business on a regular basis. Listener, I challenge you. I don't think you've ever closed any business. I don't care how much money you've made selling.
Oh, this is good.
And the reason why is, who controls the sale?
Client.
Always. Whoever signs the check controls the sale. And if you think it's anything else, you have robbed yourself. Because that thought that I control the sale has driven away extremely profitable clients who refuse to be manipulated by salespeople. You know, they can buy the same thing from a lot of other places. And if they feel you're a jerk as a salesperson, they're not going to buy from you. They're just going to quit returning your phone call. Mm-hmm. And they're going to buy from somebody else. In fact, my bet is you've closed more doors than you've closed sales with that attitude. There's only one guy I have ever met in the 35 years that I've been doing sales. His name was Gary, and he had signature authority on all his customers' checking accounts. He wrote himself a check at the end of every day for the customers he did work for. He closed his own business. But he did so by providing such extraordinary service that his customers were willing to give him that level of partnership. He was a trusted partner, not a salesperson, a trusted partner. And they saw him as a partner, even though what he sold was a commodity, building supplies, lumber, studs. That's what he sold. But what he did instead was project management. The contractors he worked with finished their houses an average of 6 weeks sooner than anybody else on the market. And what did that do to those contractors' profits? Massively magnified them. Because they could have their crews on another project 6 weeks earlier than everybody else, and you kind of increment that along over 5 or 10 years, and that's a huge increase in profitability over no difference in cost. So what Gary would do is he'd look at the weather report and say, okay, over the next week, I see we got some good weather, we got some bad weather. So he would load up truck with everything that he thought that they would need that day for an inside job or an outside job based on the weather. Every week he would send out a truck to sharpen saws and repair drills and to make sure that no worker ever had to leave the job site to get a piece of lumber or a tool.
Wow.
And that's what he did. And he's the only guy I've ever known that really closed sales. You know, the rest of the time we close sales is when the customer agrees that what you're offering is worth more than the money they are paying. And the reality is that as salespeople, what we get to do is facilitate a mutually profitable transaction. And when we can show it's mutually profitable, that's when customers say yes and they make the commitment. So that's my thoughts on closing. Stop fooling yourself. You don't close anything. You just facilitate.
So, can you share with our audience, what are the characteristics of someone like Gary? You mentioned that there is a lot of knowledge of his people, knowledge of how they do their work. Rattle off some of the characteristics that some of our closers are probably not thinking about because they're so focused on just closing the deal.
Yes.
That Gary or a Gary type person would have just as part of his DNA.
I like that. That's a great question. Thank you, Mary Lou. The first one is Gary cared way more about his customer's success than he cared about his own success. And because of that, he was number one in 57 stores, ahead of number two by 300%. He cared more about his customer's success than his own personal success. And that ties to a thought that I share with salespeople when they say, how can I position myself against my competition? And I say, stop it. Stop being a child. Instead, help your customer position themselves against their competition. And when you do that, people will do business with you because you are so valuable to them.
Perfect, indeed.
So the second thing that Gary had was foresight. Most salespeople don't have foresight beyond the next quota period. The customer's foresight runs substantially beyond the quota period. And so what he looked at was his customer's business cycle, not his business cycle. And he mapped his behavior to their business cycles, not his business cycles. And I think that's so important because once you get into that alignment, the business just flows. And the boss, you know, keeps thumbing, why can't you close something? Well, nobody's pulling out a checkbook. Well, no, you're outside of your customer's business cycles. And for Gary, because of that, he had contractors lining up to do business with him. And he would only do business with people who were easy to do business with. He had earned the right to choose his customers. He didn't work hard. He worked consistently.
Mm-hmm.
And he lived a really wonderful life because of that, with people that really cared what he did, about what he did, and cared and found value in what he did. So I think that's the third characteristic, is Gary was picky about who he did business with. The fourth characteristic of Gary is he was very pragmatic. One of his regular customers said, you know, Gary, you charge $1.59 a stud. I can go down to 84 lumber and get them for 84 cents. Man, you're ripping me off. Gary says, jump in the truck. They drove down to 84 lumber. He says, okay, let's pick some studs. All right, no, that one's crooked. Nope, that one's warped. Nope, that one's not going to work. Oh, there's a good one. Throw it on the truck. Okay, let's do another one. Okay, how long did it take for us to pick 100 good studs? Guy said, about 90 minutes. And I said, at $18 an hour for your people to do that, plus drive down and drive back, it's going to cost you probably somewhere around $1 a stud to get all this stuff done. So is my 60 cents more a stud ripping you off? Guy says, no, I get it, Gary. You always send me out straight stuff, and anything that's crooked, you fix right away. He says, that's right. I charge more. It's because it makes you easier to do your job. Mm-hmm. And so he was really good at understanding the true value and being able to illustrate it. Oh, salespeople, that is so important. And he did it through the discovery of his customer versus attempting to argue with them. He went and created an experience that was undeniable. And that customer never again questioned Gary's pricing. It was over.
Mm-hmm.
And as salespeople, we have to remember this critical concept. Adults don't argue with their own data. So when the insight comes from the customer, it's forever. Versus you attempting to argue and the customer doing their very best to be right, which kind of harks back to our starting concept of us needing to feel like we have to be right. That's just a human behavior. And because of that, customers will lie to themselves to justify their crappy behavior toward us. And that's bad. That doesn't work, because we have no idea why the business just goes away. It just does. So I think those are some of the characteristics that Gary illustrated that, quite frankly, if you do all four of those, you're going to be number one. I was in a real estate office just this past weekend, Keller Williams office here in Las Vegas, and the number one salesperson had twice the revenues of the number two salesperson, who had twice the revenues of the number three salesperson. You have to ask yourself, what's the difference between number one, number two, and number three by that, you know, doubling in each particular case? Oh, by the way, the bottom salesperson was probably 0.1% of the top salesperson.
Wow.
And you have to ask yourself, what's the difference? Are they smarter? Do they have a better product? Do they have a better process? What's the difference between these? And mm-hmm. I think salespeople, you need to ask yourself that within your own organization. I don't have specifically the answer for that particular situation, although I will bet that it's a matter of who trusts whom. The number one salesperson is usually more trusted by their customer than the number two salesperson. And the number two salesperson is more trusted by the customers than the number three salesperson. My bet is it's that level of trust, because quite frankly, the relationship is what you control. Because in any sales situation, 50% of your success is the customer's motivation. Do they want what you're offering? Is important to them? Does it create value for them? Is it something they're willing to risk their career to purchase? Risk is a big thing that kills deals. Nope, mm-hmm. You're too risky. Too risky, too risky, too risky. I feel risky. I have to, if this fails, I have to explain myself up the food chain, and that doesn't feel good.
Not at all.
My boss, I mean, he'll rip me a new one if I screw up. Oh man, that's not good. So I'm just going to say no. So motivation of risk avoidance is a big issue. 40% of our success as sales professionals is the relationship we have with our customers. Do they trust us? Do they believe us? Do they think that we are acting in their best interest, or are we just trying to close them? And 10% of our success is the product that we're offering. That surprises a lot of people because they think that's really what it's all about. Well, it's not. There's not a product out there that's unique. And the reason why is because there's a lot of ways customers can solve the problem. Even though you believe your product's unique, there's a lot of ways to solve the problem that are completely acceptable and other people have risked their career purchasing and bringing into play. And if it wasn't the case, then your competitors wouldn't be in business. So your competitors are doing a great job, at least for somebody.
Indeed.
And yet most salespeople put all their focus on the product. But see, that's not what Gary did. He put his focus on the other 90%, on the relationship, I'm your partner, and on the motivation, I'm going to help you be the best contractor you can be by managing your projects and making sure your people stay on the job, working, getting the job done. And then the lumber was ancillary in that particular case.
A byproduct.
Indeed. It just happened to be the vehicle, but it wasn't the relationship. And so I believe that from a salesperson standpoint, we have control of our relationship, which is four times more important than the product. And then we can do a really great job understanding and working with our customers' motivations. Now, may I share this idea with you about features, advantages, and benefits, which I think is a big interesting issue, especially for both prospecting and closing deals?
Yes, indeed.
Well, I was taught FAB selling, feature, advantage, benefit. Back in the 1980s when I was working for Hewlett-Packard, we'd have these really cool products. They were disruptive and they would do things nobody else could do. And we'd have these FAB charts. We'd show the features, the advantages, and the benefits that our customers would enjoy when they purchased our absolutely amazing equipment. And the FAB charts that I would create and share with my customers, I won. And then I'd take a look at the competitors' FAB charts that happened to be done by Tektronix in those days, and they'd win. How the hell could this happen? It's because our FAB charts are attempting to map our product to the customer's motivation.
Say that again.
That the FAB charts,
really,
the features,
really hit home.
And benefits is attempting to map our product to our customer's motivation.
Our product to our customer's motivation, when in fact it should be
the other way around, mapping their motivation to our product.
There you go. And that's problem, really hard to do, Mark.
Oh, yes, it is hard to do because it means that we have to, as a salesperson, stop pitching and start asking questions and listening. And we've been taught all our life that the best salespeople have the gift of gab. That's bull. The best salespeople have the gift of empathy and understanding and trying to connect with a customer and figure out how to do something bigger and better than even they can imagine.
Mark, at what point when you're going down the empathetic questioning rabbit hole, does one feel like we're intruding in our customers' lives?
This is where you get to use your professional judgment. You know, we started this conversation extremely intimately for somebody who's only had one other conversation.
Yes. Yes. True.
And so from that standpoint, you can look at the signs. And there are times when you step into a customer office and you know something else is going on. And you can say, man, you feel a little off today. What's going on? If you can share it with me. It's just a personal issue. Okay. Well, if you trust me enough to share it with me, I promise to keep it confidential and perhaps telling me could help. You know, sometimes telling it to somebody who cares, but is a disinterested, but disinterested third party can help. And I just got served with divorce papers. Oh, wow. Wow. And just be with them for a moment. Well, you know, you've got a lot to process. You've got a lot of things to think about. You know, you want me to want to have this conversation another day? How do you want this to play out today? No. I got to get this stuff done. I'm up against a deadline. I really, you know, thank you for your sympathy. I'll deal with it. Okay. Well, if there's anything I can do to refer you to a lawyers, guns, money, whatever you need, I know people who know people. So
I know people. Yeah.
And so that's where that professional judgment comes into play of mm-hmm. where do you go? You can't force it. And if there's any resistance, you back off and go, you know, blessings on you. I hope it works out for you. And, you know, I hope that you see some light in the darkness along the way. I hope you find a pony in the pile. It's until then, you know, do we proceed? Do we reschedule? What do we need to do in this moment to take you where you need to go next? And what I found is just offering that permission to defer often flips them around to say, no, let's get back. Okay. Listen, shall we just go get a cup of coffee? Maybe just kind of shift our energy and we can talk a little bit about what you have in mind and where you need to go and how you can move forward. That's it. That's mm-hmm. relationship.
Yeah. Humans. We're humans talking to humans. We sometimes forget that.
Whether you're doing B2B, B2C, it doesn't make any difference. It's still person to person. And that's why relationship is 4x more important product.
Yeah. And I have a schematic in my office that has, it's two half circles facing, mm-hmm. so like a moon facing each other, and two little tiny circles inside the bigger circles. And it's supposed to be representing belly to belly. That's really what our conversations are, belly to belly, where mm-hmm. even though we're virtual, even though we may be on the phone, you and I are on internet, I don't see your face, you don't see mine, but you know, you've got to make that connection, a human connection. And I think that the sales reps, executives who take the time to just take a deep breath and get an assessment of how your person is doing at the top of the call or whenever you want to do it is just really the way to set the tone for that mm-hmm. conversation.
Yeah, indeed. And you know, the tone, like any good piece of music, can vary. It can increase, decrease, get louder, get softer. It can go up, it can go down. Mm-hmm. And part of what we get to do is track and in some cases lead, follow sometimes you lead. I think a really good example of that, even in sales, music is a great metaphor for sales. Mm-hmm. Sometimes you step back and let somebody else solo. Sometimes you've got the spotlight and you play 16 bars.
Yeah.
But the only reason why we're playing is because we have an end in mind. The reason why customers entertain your conversations is because they see ultimate value in accomplishing their objectives, their goals, their outcomes. And they're not going to waste time working with you if that's not the case. So you have to let them lead sometimes and you have to follow, and sometimes you get to solo. So that's a really good metaphor, I believe, for what you're talking about. And I want to step back to your concept of belly to belly, because you saying it in this context really gave me a new light on it. Thank you. Bravo.
Yay.
And that is, we feel so much in our gut, in our belly. So many of our feelings come from that area of our body. Fear, satisfaction, comfort, warmth, coldness, prickles, warm fuzzies. And so when we are doing belly-to-belly kinds of conversations, that's where the empathy really comes into play. Mm-hmm. Not just cold logic. It's that, do I trust you as a human being? Do I feel good in your energy? Do I feel good in your intention? Because if I don't, I'm going to buy from somebody else. And a lot of salespeople think that's selling yourself. It's not. It's just being open. Just being open to how other people are feeling and then helping them navigate to where they want to be and how they want to feel.
And let's face it, as sales executives, salespeople, sales professionals, we chose this occupation because theoretically, quote unquote, we love dealing with people. We love talking to people. Otherwise, we would be engineers in the back room with a pizza underneath the door writing code, which is my former life.
Likewise, I'm an electrical engineer. Yes.
So, you know, we do, you know, this human aspect of sales, we can still stick on task to what we're trying to do, but we've got to open up our hearts. We've got to listen to our gut, as you said. And somewhere in there too, I'm hearing proof of concept. You've got to have the business case ready to go should you come to that type of conversation, like getting back to Gary again, where he was able to take that 84 cents and justify the gap, the delta, whatever you want to call it, because he had that story, that case study story, business case in his head ready to go. So that, you know, we need that too as part of our conversational pieces.
Absolutely. The 10% product is still important. Mapping the motivation of the product is still important. Yet the thing I think that we're talking about here is the relationship is the basis of being able to get permission to understand their motivation.
Right. To permission. Further those conversations.
That's exactly right. And relationship, when you're selling complex things, is a combination of corporate brand. Do people trust IBM? Do people trust HP? Do people trust Oracle? As well as your personal brand. Are you somebody who shows up on time or even a little before? Are you somebody who keeps their promises? Are you somebody who is mapping to the brand of the customer? One of the things I learned decades ago is that an executive will never bring somebody into their inner circle that will embarrass them. Never.
Right.
So as a salesperson, I have to have behaviors and language patterns and dress codes and speech patterns that are acceptable to the executives I'm selling to. And while that doesn't necessarily seem fair, they're writing the checks. They get to choose that culture. So if we don't fit their culture, if we don't augment their culture, there's no way it's going to happen.
Hmm. So true. I've seen so many blogs and posts on LinkedIn about the dress, about the appearance, you know, what it's amazing now, the conversations around that, because we grew up in the 80s and 90s of selling where it was you did have to dress the part. You did have to look at your clients and prospects and dress the way they dress. If they are casual, if you're there on casual Friday, you're not going to show up in a suit. You know, you're definitely going to be a part of the team.
Right. And that said, you always wanted to dress just a little better than the person that you're going to be talking to. Mm-hmm. And you and I grew up in an era where John T. Malloy's Dress for Success was required reading of any sales professional.
And there was one Dress for Success for Women.
Oh, yes, absolutely. Yeah. Oh, yeah. Oh. Without a doubt. It across the board.
Yes. No gigantic necklaces. And I see a lot of women today wearing those. And it's funny, I think back to that book.
Oh, yeah.
Pearls or, you know, nothing.
Simple, you know, no big diamonds. Yep, you wear the diamond ring, but nothing else. And no big hoop earrings. No.
That was, exactly. This is bringing back memories.
But the thing to keep in mind is remember the folks that are writing multi-million dollar checks read that book.
Yep.
And embrace those principles.
Exactly.
And so there's a bit of that it just depends on where you wish to play in the marketplace. And there was a time when I put on a tie because I knew that's how I made money. Mm-hmm. Maybe it's time for me to do that again.
Yeah. So we're getting to the point where we're going to wrap up, Mark. I could talk to you forever, but I know our audience is like, okay, Mary Lou. We're there now. So,
all right. Half a dozen great points. Thanks very much. Kind of went a little differently than I expected, but
we can always have another conversation later about
anytime. I got plenty.
Very good.
So we'll find some new things just like we did in this conversation. The conversation brought out new ideas for me. Thank you very much.
You're welcome. So how do people get a hold of you, Mark?
Best way is marksonlinkedin.com. Let's hook up on LinkedIn. I find that's a safe place for us to meet from a business standpoint. I write an article every week about customers and sales. And by the way, Gary's story is up there someplace in my LinkedIn articles. And let's do that. If you think this is interesting, shoot me a message on LinkedIn. I'll be delighted to connect with you. And in fact, I have a call a little later on today from a guy who reached out just yesterday and said, you know, you seem to be an interesting guy. Let's have a conversation. I'm delighted to give anybody 15, 30 minutes of my time because I always learn.
Yes. And I think, you know, this conversation today, while we usually stick to process and metrics and things like that, there is a whole other side to selling and selling professionally and selling that, you know, through being authentic that I think this conversation was just really wonderful for that, because we do, we are humans, we are selling people to people, belly to belly. Mm-hmm. And it's important that we polish and sharpen the saws, not only on the methods and systems and framework side, but also on that conversational side, the gut, the heart. You know, my kids used to go to a Waldorf school and they taught head, hands, and heart. Mm. That's how the curriculum for that school.
That was a 3H.
Yes. And that for the selling, it's the same thing. You know, the head would be all of the business cases, use cases, mm-hmm. stories that compel people to move further into the pipeline. The hand is really understanding that you're human on the other end and what their struggles, challenges, priorities, goals are, and how
their motivation. Yes.
Yeah. And then the heart is knowing that in your heart, you're going to be able to help them, but you've got to let them drive the train. But you help steer it and you guide them.
Well, you help fuel it.
Force it. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. Yeah, that's exactly right. And that's how it works. It's all important. Yeah. But I got to tell you, if you don't have the heart, you got nothing. It's unsustainable.
Yeah, definitely.
It's all important. All of it's important. All of it got to be there.
Well, let me get you on the spot, because I wrote down 10% is product, 40% is the success. What's the other 50?
Relationship. 40% is relationship. 50% is motivation. 50% motivation, 40% relationship, 10% product.
Okay. So for those of you out there saying, wait a minute, I didn't get that other 50%. We just got it.
Yeah. Motivation. Yeah. So you know, I don't care how good you are. If they're not motivated, they're not going to buy it. And if they don't trust you, they're not going to buy it. And so that's why the product is there. Now, one, maybe 15 seconds more. Here's the reason why. Even though you have customers that may have a relationship with another vendor, if you can better understand your customer's motivation, their current vendor, you can take them out. And I've got processes to do that. I can take out an existing vendor with 6 questions. If it's possible, those 6 questions will take them out. And we'll leave that for another podcast.
Yes, that is a cliffhanger. Yay. Okay, audience, you need to call Mark now to find out those 6. I love cliffhangers. Mark, thank you so much for your time. I enjoyed speaking with you, and we'll just keep in touch for sure.
You know it.